Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Jason Rosenhaus, who is the co-editor of The Mathematics of Various Entertaining Subjects. This book covers a multitude of topics and is in many ways as entertaining as the various subjects it describes. Even though the book can be skimmed simply to expose one to various aspects of recreational mathematics, I think it's fair to say that some mathematical background is needed to fully appreciate it. But even if you're only willing to skim the book, you're going to find sections which will make you want to dive in more deeply. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Recreational mathematics seems like an oxymoron to a lot of people. What exactly is recreational mathematics and what role does it play in the development of mathematics? Where are people likely to encounter it?
Well, I can understand why people might find that confusing. I mean, recreational implies that you're doing it for fun. And I think for a lot of people outside the mathematical community, maybe it doesn't always seem like math can be fun. But really what recreational mathematics is, at least the way we conceive it, is that it's mathematics that's inspired by games and puzzles or brain teasers or just ultimately any sort of mathematics where you're undertaking it just for the fun of it and not with, say, a specific physical problem in mind and not necessarily with intending to extend the theory of some established branch of mathematics. So a simple example might be, if you look at something like a Sudoku puzzle, lots of people like Sudoku puzzles and, you know, books of Sudoku puzzles sell very well at bookstores. But a mathematician looking at a Sudoku puzzle would probably ask questions like, how many Sudoku grids are there? How many puzzles can you make? How many puzzles can you make if you take symmetry into consideration? And things like that. So that very roughly is what recreational math is. Now, the funny thing is, you can point to a lot of major, well-established branches of mathematics, and you find that they had their origins in recreational problems. One of my favorite examples is probability theory, which nowadays is one of the, you know, established branches of mathematics with applications in all sorts of other sciences, and it's now just a standard part of every math student's education. And yet, if you look at the origins, the first serious work in probability theory was done by people like Pascal and Fermat, and they were considering a very practical problem given to them by a professional gambler of the time. He was just wondering about the, you know, proper gambling strategies under certain circumstances. And in just thinking about that problem and in doing what was reasonable to solve that problem, they developed a lot of the major techniques of recreational mathematics. So that's kind of the idea. It's that very often mathematics undertaken simply for its recreational value, simply because people thought it was just fun to look at look at this topic, very often turns out to be the beginning of a major development in mathematics.
You know, I can recall two instances in which major recreational mathematics found its way into the general public. And when I was younger, this might be a little before your time, there was something called the 15 puzzle, which consisted of sliding tiles. And an updated variation of that was in the 1980s with Rubik's Cube. So I know that people have at least seen recreational mathematics, even though they may not realize it's recreational mathematics when they see it.
Yeah, those are both good examples. And of course, the Rubik's Cube, Erno Rubik was a professional mathematician, right, who developed a cube to illustrate certain algebraic principles. So those are other good examples, I think.
Was there an overarching theme to the book, or did you just choose topics that appeal to you?
Well, the overarching theme I don't know if there was an overarching theme, but the book arose out of a conference in recreational math that was held in New York City, and it was sponsored by the Museum of Mathematics. And if any of our listeners live in the general vicinity of New York City, I strongly recommend that they pay a visit to the museum. It's really quite a wonderful place. And the organizer of the museum, Cindy Lawrence, decided they were looking for a way of just sort of promoting, you know, mathematics, you know, in the community. And they came up with this idea of hosting a serious conference on recreational math. Maybe that sounds like a contradiction in terms, a serious conference in recreational math. But the point is, it was for problems that were recreational, problems that were inspired by games and puzzles, like we were just discussing, but also for, you know, serious, you know, mathematical research into those areas. So they had the idea for this conference, and the name of the conference was The Mathematics of Various Entertaining Subjects. And the, you know, the acronym there is MOVES. So we refer to it as the MOVES Conference in New York. So the book is essentially a conference proceedings for that conference. It's not strictly a conference proceedings. Not all of the papers were presented there, but it's effectively a proceedings of that conference. So the papers that we publish in the book are really just whatever, you know, people submitted. We put out a general call to anyone who participated in the conference, said if you would like to submit a paper, please feel free to send it to us. And we tend to take a very broad view of what recreational mathematics is. And so the papers are really quite diverse. But they also organize themselves, you know, loosely around certain themes. So that was sort of the genesis and the origin of the book. So I can just leave it there.
Yeah, you know, the first essay in the book is short and is entitled, Should You Be Happy? I think it's an excellent use of mathematics to answer common questions that have intriguing mathematics lurking just below the surface.
So that particular paper was by Peter Winkler. And he's quite a well-known guy in mathematical circles. He's published several books of sort of highbrow mathematical brain teasers. And yeah, he has a real gift for finding brain teasers. You know, by brain teasers, I mean little puzzles that you could tell someone, even if they don't have much mathematical background, they could still understand what the puzzle is asking and what they're being asked to do. And he has a real gift for finding these seemingly simple puzzles that you can describe. And then showing how in trying to solve them, you're inevitably led to more serious mathematical principles. The Should You Be Happy of the title refers to a couple of problems that are based on probability theories. Maybe a little hard to give the details in this context, but the basic idea of all the problems he discusses are, you're playing a game with some other person and some rules change is suggested that at first blush might seem like it's to your advantage. But then when you do a little probabilistic analysis, you realize that actually you should not be happy. That's the genesis of the title there.
Well, I must admit, when you were describing Peter Winkler, who is unknown to me, possibly because I'm older, there was a mathematician, John Conway of my generation, who did a similar type of thing. He would see puzzles that lurk below the surface and construct games and intriguing situations in which to place them.
Oh, yeah. Well, John Conway, I mean, he's one of the godfathers of putting recreational mathematics onto a serious footing. He, along with two other people, Richard Guy and Elwin Berlekamp, published a series of books quite a while ago. I'm blanking on the day. I think it was probably in the 1970s that they published it. It might have been more recent. But the books were called Winning Ways for Your Mathematical Plays. That was the title of the book.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was a whole and it was essentially exactly what we're talking about. It was a sort of serious mathematical analysis of, you know, games and puzzles, more games in their case. And actually, this might be a good time to mention, you know, the book that we're discussing was the proceedings of the first MOVES conference. These conferences are held every 2 years. And the second conference was held this past August. And it was actually, the conference was specifically in honor of Berlekamp, Guy, and Conway. And my co-editor, Jennifer Beinecke, and I are actually in the process of putting together the second book in the series, which is in part a tribute to them. So, they're definitely big names in recreational mathematics.
Okay, well, keep me on the mailing list for volume two.
Oh, happy to do so.
Okay. I enjoyed the essay on one-move problems, Some of the problems were familiar to me and maybe to some of our listeners, especially since the solutions are often ingenious but not complicated. The weighing problem is a good example. Perhaps you could describe it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, that puzzle is, that paper is actually a lot of fun, precisely for the reason you say that what the paper is a survey of puzzles that can be solved in one move, right? So there's like one clever trick, to solving each problem, which when you see it, makes the problem very clear, but until you see it, it sounds impossible. The author of that paper was a fellow named Anani Levitin, he's another one who's actually a pretty well-known guy. He's the co-author of a book called Algorithmic Puzzles. So if you like the paper, you should definitely check out his book as well. Now, the coin weighing puzzle that you actually mentioned, as you say, that's one of the more famous puzzles. The actual puzzle is pretty easy to state. For the purposes of this conversation, I'll give a slightly simplified version of it. The idea is that you imagine you have, say, three bags of gold and gold coins, I should say. And, two of the bags contain real gold and one of the bags contains counterfeit gold. And what we know is the real gold, let's give it away. Let's say the real gold coins weigh 1 pound each and the fake gold, let's say, weighs 1 pound and 1 ounce. So it's a little bit heavier. And then your puzzle is this. You have a scale that you can use to do weighings, but it's a penny scale. You have to put a penny in, and then you put something on the scale, and it tells you how much weight you put on the scale. But you only have one penny. So the game is, how can you do this with one weighing? How can you take some coins out of the bags, put them on the scale, get one weighing, and then from that, figure out which bag has the fake gold? I describe that as a slightly simplified version. Of course, there's nothing special about three bags. If you want to go for glory, you can try four bags or five bags or in principle any number of bags. Now, this is quite a well-known puzzle, and it's funny that you bring it up because just yesterday, by sheer coincidence, I was watching some late-night television and a rerun of Columbo came on. Remember Columbo?
Of course. Yeah. Great show.
Well, a rerun of Columbo came on, and sure enough, that puzzle came up in the episode. The bad guy was the head of a high IQ society, and he gives that puzzle to Columbo early in the episode. And then sure enough, later in the episode, Columbo solves the puzzle and he prints the solution. So I got all excited. Like that puzzle's in our book, right? And talk about mathematics and popular culture. So anyway, yeah, that's a very famous puzzle. And it's a good example of what Professor Levitin means when he talks about puzzles that can be solved in one move. There's one clever trick. Should we discuss the solution, or should we leave it as a?
Actually, I think what we'll do is I think we'll leave it because what I hope will happen, it will pique the curiosity of our listeners who can't stand to have puzzles unresolved, and they will rush right out and get a copy of your book.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's a good approach.
Oh, okay. Anyway, mazes have fascinated me ever since I encountered them in Williamsburg and also at Hampton Court in England. And I was intrigued by the connection with the traveling salesman problem, which is deep.
That's another fun paper. Mazes are another example of sort of a recreational topic. There's a rich mathematical theory surrounding mazes. But at the same time, I think, everyone has enjoyed working out a maze at some point. There's actually a large hedge maze near where I live, which I had fun wandering through a while back.
Oh, maybe you do live near Williamsburg.
Williamsburg is sort of on the other side of the state from where I live. So it's a couple of hours. I was thinking of a different hedge maze at Luray Caverns, just in case any of our listeners are familiar with that.
From the standpoint of a Californian, Virginia is a small state.
I guess,
you can get from one side to the other in a very short period of time.
That is certainly true. I guess it's all a matter of perspective. The three authors of that one, Bosch, Chartier, and Rowan, were the three authors. What they're doing there is they're making mazes that look like historical figures. Like one of their main creations, and actually use this as one of the cover images on the book, is a maze where the lines and paths in the maze kind of look like Buddha, and if ever there was a recreational puzzle, this is it. The puzzle being, how do you design a maze that looks like an historical figure? I don't think they were studying that for its practical significance. But there too, the cool thing is that techniques that you can use to do it are inspired by things like the traveling salesman problem and problems of Fourier series and whatnot. And yeah, and that, it's sort of a perfect example of what we're talking about, of a of how a, just a purely recreational topic, just something you're studying just for the fun of it, just naturally gives rise to really serious techniques in mathematics. And yes, yeah, so that's definitely a fun paper. I mean, that's a paper that's worth reading just for the diagrams alone. You know, the figures are so attractive that it's fun just to flip through.
You know, here's another classic problem. Graph puzzles have been around since the bridges of Königsberg, but you had some very intriguing ones in which graphs are tied up with probability.
Yeah, so that's a paper by actually my co-editor, Jennifer Beinecke, and her father, Lowell Beinecke. Lowell Beinecke is actually you know, quite a famous graph theorist. In fact, he was a graph theorist before it was cool to be a graph theorist. I mean, he was one of the real pioneers in the subject. And he's a former editor of the College Mathematics Journal. Yeah. So as you say, yeah, graph theory was largely recreational in its origin. In fact, I mentioned probability theory at the start of this conversation. I could easily have mentioned graph theory as another subject where recreational problems inspired the theory. Now, you mentioned the bridges of Königsberg. Maybe we should mention what that is for listeners who aren't familiar. This was a problem studied by Euler. Königsberg was a city in Austria. And it was there were a number of canals and rivers that partitioned the town into various regions, including an island or two. And there was a sequence of bridges that connected the various regions of the town. And it was sort of a problem that people sometimes wondered about. Was there some way of walking between the various land masses over various bridges? Could you do that in such a way that you used every bridge exactly once and also started in the same landmass where you ended? And this was just sort of a little recreational problem. And, nowadays we tend to look at that as a fairly simple problem. Euler, the way Euler solved it was one of the first uses of what we now call graph theory. He modeled the land masses as dots, basically, and the bridges as lines joining the dots. And he was able to come up with a condition just from looking at that diagram. He came up with a condition that would guarantee whether or not you had this sort of path, that he was interested in. And it was so as I say, nowadays, I mean, this is something we teach students early on. But at the time, that was pioneering stuff. The idea of, modeling the problem in that way. And then in the 1800s, mathematicians like Hamilton were actually marketing puzzles based on graph theoretic problems. Hamilton marketed a puzzle where the goal was to walk around the edges of a dodecahedron and to do that in a way so now that you hit every vertex, every corner exactly once without using any corner more than once. And again, he actually sold this. People, it was sort of like the Rubik's Cube of the time. People bought this just because it was fun, it was a fun problem to work on. But starting from there, starting in the mid-1800s, people realized that these kinds of diagrams, these dots and lines diagrams that we now call graphs, they just came up everywhere. I mean, they were just useful for solving all sorts of problems. The four-color problem, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that's another example. Can you color a map if you picture like a map of the United States showing all the individual states? Or maybe a map of the counties in England or something like that. Can you color the map using only four colors in such a way that neighboring regions do not share the same color? Well, people realize that's basically a graph theory problem. And the paper by Jennifer Beinecke and Lowell Beinecke in the book is basically taking a couple of puzzles that are inspired by graphs in various ways. And then, showing how, the same pattern, that when you try to solve those puzzles, you're led to some pretty significant results in graph theory. There was one you mentioned to me the other day about, Schroeder-Bernstein theorem, which is a problem about sets. I mean, it's a problem about showing a certain one-to-one correspondences among sets. And they show how you can actually solve that using graph theory, which was a very creative thing. That was something I had never seen before, frankly, when I read that paper.
Yeah, there's a proof involving Tarski's theorem on complete lattices, which makes it a slam dunk, which I always remember because it was so attractive and it sort of falls in line with the one move solution, because one move is something that not only applies to puzzles, it applies to chess, it applies to various games like that, and it also applies to, when Archimedes realized the one move that would reveal whether or not the crown was made of an alloy or pure gold. One move solutions to problems are always appealing.
Yeah, they certainly are. And it's funny I'm not familiar with that specific proof that you mentioned. But certainly the Schroeder-Bernstein theorem is one that has a very large number of proofs attached to it. The proof you usually see in textbooks of real analysis, that's usually the venue where that theorem comes up. Usually the proofs that I've seen presented there are usually quite complicated, to be honest.
Yeah, they're tedious. It's sort of like I can remember we're diverging a little, but that's perfectly okay. I remember when I was in high school and we proved the binomial theorem by means of induction, and it was really pretty difficult. And then when I took a course in combinatorics, I saw the slam dunk proof of the binomial theorem using combinatorics. It was just great.
Yeah. Good.
You know, getting on to more puzzles that appear in your book, I first learned what is now called the Temple of Hanoi problem in Gamow's classic book, 1-2-3 Infinity, where it is called the Temple of Benares problem. Uh-huh. Computer programming students learn to solve it recursively, but you discuss how to solve it using random moves, which sort of surprised me.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Towers of Hanoi, that's an old workhorse among recreational mathematics. The basic puzzle, maybe we can probably describe that one. The basic puzzle is that you have, say, three pegs, and let's pick a concrete number. Let's say five disks. And the disks are stacked in order of radius. So the one with the largest radius is on the bottom, and then the next smallest is on top, and next smallest and next smallest. So you have these five disks of different sizes, and they're arranged with the smallest one on top and the largest one on the bottom. And then the goal of the puzzle is to move the disks onto one of the other pegs, but there's a certain rule you have to follow. And the rule is this. You can transfer the top disk from one of the pegs onto another one of the pegs, but you are never allowed to put a smaller disk, you are never allowed to put a larger disk on top of a smaller disk. That's really the only rule. So if you only had two disks, this would be an easy problem, right? You would take the small disk and put it on one of the pegs, and then you would put the larger disk on the third peg. And then on your next move, you could take the smallest disk and putting it on top of the larger disk. And then you have now moved those two disks from one peg to another peg. But this gets quite difficult if you have, I said, five pegs. Suddenly the number of moves you need to do this is quite a bit larger. And if you kick it up to, say, 10 pegs, it's still doable. But boy, does it take a lot of moves to do it. And there's an old legend surrounding this problem, which is that some monks in a monastery somewhere have a very large version of this puzzle with like 64 disks or something like that. And they're dutifully transferring the disks, doing the moves you need to do to transfer the disks from one peg to another. And the legend goes that when they finally finish this, the world will come to an end.
Yeah, that's actually described in the Temple of Benares problem in 1-2-3 Infinity. And to make it more attractive, you want to find where it is, because the spikes are made of diamonds and the discs are made of gold. Oh. And I'm not sure whether or not you're familiar with this, but there's a wonderful science fiction story called, by Arthur C. Clarke, called The 9 Billion Names of God, in which what he does is he does an updated version of this. When I say updated, I think the story was written in the early 1950s.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, I remember that story, and it's funny. I was actually just thinking of that story while we were discussing this. Yeah. So that's another one. I wouldn't be surprised if that story is actually available online somewhere. So something else for our listeners to check out. Yeah. Now the thing about the Towers of Hanoi. It's a classic example of an inductive process. So the idea is that let's go back to the five disk version, which I mentioned. If you want to move the five disks from say the first peg to the third peg, in broad strokes, it's clear what needs to be done. First, you take the first four pegs and you do that like its own puzzle. Like you transfer the first four pegs onto say the second peg, or excuse me, the first four disks onto the second peg. Then that liberates the largest disk, and you move that to the third peg, and then you repeat the process. Once again, you move the four disks on top of the third peg, on top of the large disk on the third peg. So the idea is that once you know how to solve the four-disk puzzle, you automatically know how to solve the five-disk puzzle, and you can kind of see that the number of moves would roughly double each time you do this. You basically have to do the four, solving the five-disk puzzle is effectively solving the four-disk puzzle twice. And then once you can do the five-disk puzzle, then you can translate that into the six-disk puzzle. That's the Towers of Hanoi. And there's a rich literature on that problem and on variations on the problem. The authors of that paper, that was Max Alexeyev and Toby Berger were the authors on that paper. They study a number of variations on that puzzle. And one of the cool things that they do there is that they show that certain techniques from physics, actually, from the physics of electric circuits, are actually useful in understanding the solutions to that puzzle. And that was kind of one of the main points of their paper. And that was another one that was a new one to me. It's a very interesting experience, and maybe this is a digression too, but it's a very interesting experience editing a book like this. Because we received a big pile of submissions for the book, and I was reading them as an editor, but I was also just reading them as a fan, because they had all sorts of games and puzzles and techniques that I had never seen before. I learned a lot just from editing the papers from the book, and this one was a new one on me, that the physics of electric circuits is actually relevant to the Towers of Hanoi, this old workhorse in recreational mathematics.
Well, one of the things that has always enchanted me about mathematics is how it just seems to crop up practically everywhere. And one of the things that I think that your book is useful for, even though it's pitched at a higher level, is that we have a problem intriguing students nowadays with mathematics, because there's so much in the way of entertainment going on. And I think what you have to do is, I think you have to insert intriguing mathematics earlier into the curriculum so that students really start to enjoy it the way that we enjoy it. And a great way to do this is puzzles, because the human mind seems to be wired in such a way that puzzles appeal to us.
Yeah, I think that's true. So first of all, just about the book itself, the point you raise actually is worth emphasizing. We should be clear that this is not a popular level book. I mean, this is not a layperson might find some of the papers pretty tough going. We certainly did not shy away from including the equations and some of the technical details. But we did make a real effort that the papers be generally readable. Even if you don't want to parse all of the equations and chase through every little piece of notation, you can still follow the flow of what the people are talking about. So it's sort of it's not a popular level book, but we did endeavor, compared to other high level math books, we did endeavor to be very readable. And in fact, I would mention specifically the first four papers in the book. We put that in a section called vignettes. By which we meant papers that are mathematically lighter than the others. That Mays paper we were discussing was in that category. The one-move puzzles was in that category. Yeah. So I wouldn't say the book is light reading. But on the other hand, if you're the kind of person who thinks a book called The Mathematics of Various Entertaining Subjects might be interesting, I think you'll be able to get something out of it. Okay, so that was the idea there. Now, what you say about puzzles is, I think, exactly right. People will always say, oh, I hate math. But they like solving puzzles. I mentioned Sudoku puzzles, earlier. And if you buy pretty much any book on Sudoku puzzles, if you read the introduction to the book, they usually have a warning where they say, even though we're using numbers, even though it's numbers you're writing down in the puzzle, this is not a math puzzle. Okay, you're not doing math. Okay. And I think mathematicians reading things like that get a little frustrated, because I mean Sudoku, those are logic puzzles that you're doing. Those are just straight up logic puzzles. And as far as we're concerned, that is a math problem. So what you say is exactly right. People tend to like games and puzzles. Even people who think they hate math will get intrigued if you give them a clever brain teaser, if you give them, say, the Monty Hall problem or something like that. Suddenly they'll get intrigued by it.
People absolutely love that.
I'm sorry?
People absolutely love that.
Oh, yeah. And what you say is right. It's that what people don't like is arithmetic.
All true.
Yeah, and what people don't like is computation, and what people don't like, frankly, is feeling confused. Right? I mean, it's not math specifically; it's feeling confused, and it's just those two, I think, often go together. It can sometimes seem like a foreign language class. So I think that's a real issue. I think one of the reasons people come out hating math is that in elementary and middle school, we spend so much time just hammering arithmetic and hammering just rote algorithms, for solving problems without, you're taught these algorithms and you memorize them. But even there, you never learn about the reasons the algorithms work. I mean, it's something that's just handed down and you're supposed to memorize them. So this is a real issue because it's very hard to strike the right balance. I mean, obviously we want kids to be able to do basic arithmetic. I mean, that is an important skill. But when that's all they see, they really come by the time I get them in college, they just have completely the wrong idea of what mathematics is. And this is something I struggle with when I try to educate college students. In fact, I have a joke that I like to make that I think a lot of my college students have this idea that in a math class, there is a tacit contract between the student and the professor. And the contract says this, says they, as the student, will learn whatever techniques I give them. Okay. They'll memorize my formulas. Okay. They'll memorize the theorems. And then when test time comes around, they will repeat those formulas with machine-like precision. But if I ever ask them to, say, prove something or explain why something is true or reason their way to something, they get viscerally upset. Like, that's a major breach of etiquette that I would ask them to do that. Like, I'm not holding up my end of the bargain. So that's another goal of a book like this. It's that to mathematicians, mathematics is not about reaching for the nearest formula and just applying it mindlessly. For mathematicians, the interesting part is discovering what the formula is in the first place. That's the really interesting part. And I think, math, giving people games and puzzles and brain teasers and then showing them, hey, this little brain teaser just leads you very naturally into these very abstract constructions in mathematics. I think that can do a lot of good.
One of the things that you might consider doing, because you've written certain books before, is you might consider looking at what is accessible for, say, middle school students, starting from the approach of introducing it via puzzles. People do this sporadically, but they don't do it as, they'll write an article on it, or they'll, or they'll mention it in a class sometime. But you could probably develop a reasonable amount of mathematics this way. But I'd like to get back to the book for a second, because actually, we could talk about education, and the students in Virginia are obviously not much different from those in California, but because it's your book that we're talking about, let's go back to it.
We'll do a separate conversation to solve the problem.
We'll do that when you get your next book written and send me a copy. Okay. Anyway, coin weighing problems, which we discussed before, seem to have been around forever. I've always wondered if there was a different methodology depending upon whether the counterfeit coin is known to be of lower weight compared to the real coins, or whether it is merely known to have a different weight. I don't know if I've phrased this clearly.
Well, that's actually roughly the subject of the paper you have in mind, which was written by Tanya Kovanova, who's another one who's actually kind of a big name for these kinds of problems, recreational problems. She actually runs a math blog, which I'm sure you can find with Google, where she often discusses problems of this sort. Coin weighing problems, you could very easily write a book just on coin weighing problems. There are so many variations on the basic theme. We were discussing one earlier about, the one I mentioned where you have several bags of coins and one of them has fake coins. And in that one, what made it such an interesting problem is that you only had one weighing. The kinds of problems that Kovanova is discussing in that paper are a bit more complicated. So there you have, some number of coins, and you have what's called a balanced scale. Okay, so you don't get an absolute number for the weight, but you can see if different piles of coins balance. And she's discussing very general sorts of weighing problems where you have some number of coins. Let maybe you have, say, like 9 coins, and you're trying to find one counterfeit coin. And I think, as you say, I think in the traditional version of the problem, you usually assume that the coin is heavier than the others, and that's actually relevant. In the problems that Kovanova is discussing, all we know is that the fake coin has a different weight from the real coins. We don't know whether it's heavier or lighter, and that actually significantly complicates things. And what she's asking is are very general problems. If you have a certain, rather than doing problems like you have 9 coins, one of them is heavier, how many weighings do you need? That's a very concrete sort of problem. But for a mathematician, it's very natural to want to generalize things. So a mathematician would say, well, why should I study that specific problem? Why don't I say you have N coins and K of them are fake, and I have a scale with L many pans, and how many weighings do I need to distinguish the fake coin given all of these very abstract conditions? So that's what Kovanova is doing in that paper. To be honest, I've now read that paper so long ago, I don't remember the specific technique she used to do that. But that was kind of the that was the theme that she was doing, and it's a really nice example of how mathematicians think. You don't like to just solve the puzzle that's in front of you. You like to try to generalize things, and you like to try to come up with methods that are applicable to the largest number of puzzles you can get away with. That's a really nice puzzle, and that's another one where the mathematics isn't really too dense. I think most readers would be able to follow that one to the end.
You know, there was an absolutely fascinating section on crossword puzzles. I've always been a devotee of crossword puzzles because my mother was fascinated by both crossword puzzles and double cross sticks and reserved an hour of the day for doing them. Most of us think of these as testing our facility with both the language and how well we are informed, but there is a lot of mathematics connected with both the design and solution of crossword puzzles.
Yeah, and that paper actually, that's one I found especially interesting, actually for exactly the same reason you say. I happen to really love crossword puzzles, but I had never really thought much about the mathematics underlying them. Now, the fellow who wrote that paper, that was John McSweeney, who, as I recall, is at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology. He did something really interesting in that paper, something I thought was very clever. What he's actually doing isn't so much constructing crossword puzzles, but he's talking about how do you measure the difficulty of a crossword puzzle. That's kind of a tricky question. Is there some objective mathematical way of measuring how difficult a crossword puzzle is? And what he did in that paper that I thought was really clever was that he realized that you can model this problem using techniques from epidemiology, of all things. One thing epidemiologists study is how do diseases spread through a population? So initially you have, one or maybe a small number of people who are infected, and then they infect others and they infect others. And then you get this sort of cascading effect where, for a while, it's only a very small number of people who have the illness. But then at some point you reach critical mass and suddenly it just cascades. And what McSweeney realized was that solving a crossword puzzle is the same kind of thing. You start with an empty grid. It's a difficult puzzle. It's always very difficult to get started. How do you get those first words? You always look for those gimme clues, the ones that you can be absolutely sure you're correct on. And then, so for a while, it's very difficult. You fill in one word and it's going very slowly. But at some point you have enough words filled in so that you get enough cross letters, on the various other words. And then suddenly the solving goes a little faster and a little faster. And then at some point you have so much of the puzzle solved that the whole thing just sort of collapses and you're able to fill in the whole puzzle. And he said that's the, mathematicians would call that a cascading process like that. The sort of process that starts off slow and then gets faster and faster, that's a cascading process. And there are various mathematical models for understanding those kinds of processes. And McSweeney did that was so clever was to realize that you can use those models for analyzing something like crossword puzzle difficulty. So, I had a good time. The mathematics, there's a lot of statistical analysis in that paper, too. That's actually a perfect example of a paper where, as it goes along, it actually does get fairly dense. I mean, I think if you really try to follow every equation, that might be a difficult paper to read for a lot of people. And yet, most of the paper will be very followable. You can follow what he is doing, even if you don't understand every symbol in every equation.
You were discussing Sudoku puzzles earlier, and Sudoku puzzles don't quite cascade in the same fashion. With most Sudoku puzzles, and you're an expert, but I like doing them. Most Sudoku puzzles, what you can do is you can fill in things early relatively easily using a few basic stratagems. Then towards the middle of the puzzle, it becomes very difficult, and at the end, it all collapses.
Yeah. So that's funny. Now, if I may mention, I'm the co-author of a book about the mathematics of Sudoku, my co-author being Laura Talman. So, so that's why I keep mentioning, Sudoku puzzles. What you say is correct there. Now, it's interesting because there's actually a rich literature on how to measure the difficulty of Sudoku puzzles, too. How do you measure? In newspapers, you'll often see, this is a one-star puzzle or a three-star puzzle. And you might wonder, how do they measure the difficulty? As you say, it's not really a cascading process in the same way that the crossword puzzles are. And yet there is some very rich mathematics, surrounding that. And basically what it comes down to is that the difficulty of the puzzle is measured relative to the complexity of the techniques that are needed. So you mentioned, usually right at the start, you can fill in a few freebies. There are a few where it's just obvious for various reasons what to fill in the cell. But then there are much more difficult techniques that require really elaborate chains of logic, right? And if you need those techniques, then you get a much harder puzzle. So you're absolutely right. Sudoku puzzles have to a certain extent replaced crossword puzzles. Maybe I shouldn't say replace, but Sudoku puzzle books tend to sell better than crossword puzzle books these days. They have a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. So it's an interesting comparison there.
I'm a big devotee of card tricks because I spent a lot of my youth as a card player, and I've never heard of the ice cream trick. Perhaps you could explain how it is performed to our audience, and we'll let your book explain the rationale behind it.
Yeah, so that's a really fun paper. I mean, mathematical card tricks, that's another one where there's just a vast literature of mathematical card tricks. In fact, I have one I like to do on the first day of class as an icebreaker with my students. I have a very famous mathematical card trick that I like to do. And I always tell them on the first day of class, I say, sometime during the semester, I'll tell you how I did that trick, but I won't tell you ahead of time what day that will be. So you have to come to class every single day, because that might be the day when I'll show you how I did that card trick. Now the paper you're talking about, that was co-authored by Colm Mulcahy with another fellow named Neil Calkin. But Colm Mulcahy is actually a big name in this area. He just recently published a book of mathematical card tricks. He's been writing a column for the Mathematical Association of America, the MAA, their website. He's been writing a column. It's called Card Column, right? His name is Colm, C-O-L-M, so it's Card Column. And so he's a very famous guy in this area of mathematical card tricks. Now, what the ice cream trick actually is, and that's what the paper discusses. He has this trick called the ice cream trick, and then he discusses the mathematical principles underlying it. But what the trick actually is you take a relatively small pile of cards, maybe 15 to 20 cards, and you ask the spectator, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And they'll say something like chocolate, let's say. Then you spell out chocolate, C-H-O-C, dealing out one card each time. And you do this process. You count out one card, and then you put the remaining cards on top. And then you ask another spectator, hey, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And they'll say, I don't know, vanilla. And you spell out vanilla, and someone else might say strawberry. So you spell out strawberry. And you do this, and what it looks like you're doing is that it looks like you're basically just shuffling the cards based on the completely random suggestions of these audience members who are, in fact, not in on the trick, right? I mean, this is not something you prepare ahead of time. And yet, at the end of all this, you say, the magician is now able to tell you exactly what the top card is. He'll say something like, okay, turn over the top card, it's the four of diamonds, and it'll turn it over, and sure enough, if you did the trick properly, it really will be the four of diamonds. And it's a really good card trick, because it just seems impossible. I mean, it really seems like you really are just shuffling the cards in this totally random, arbitrary way, and that so much is just out of your control as the magician, that there's just no way you could possibly know what the top card will be. And yet, because of certain mathematical principles underlying the exact manner in which you're shuffling the cards, you actually can control which card is going to end up on top. And that's the idea. And that's the idea of the trick. And that's what the rest of the paper is discussing, is the mathematical principles that make this work. But it's a very cool trick, because once you understand a little bit of the mathematics, you can actually go and perform this for friends. I mean, it's not one where you need years of training and sleight of hand to do it. You just learn a few basic things, and the trick takes care of itself. And that's what's so much fun about it.
Well, one of the things that I used to do when I was teaching is we would have a day at school in which we would open the school up to the elementary school classes. And what I would do is I would do mathematical card tricks coupled with a very, very small amount of sleight of hand that you need to distract people for, but I always had somebody to help me do that. And I had one teacher come back and see my performance several straight years. And then once afterwards, he came up to me and he said, our students voted and you were the second most popular demonstration at school, following only the boa constrictor in the biology department.
Wow. Yeah.
And I said, that's high praise indeed.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to compete with a boa constrictor.
Yeah, I'm not up to eating a live mouse. Uh-huh. But yes, it just goes to show that these things are so appealing at such a young age. We've just got to take more advantage of doing it.
Yeah, I'll bet the mouse probably preferred your talk, though.
Anyway, getting back to your book, one of the things that, as I said, I had a long involvement when I was young with card playing, card games. And so when I read a certain chapter, I asked, what exactly is heartless poker, and how do the probabilities and the associated hand rankings differ from those in regular poker, which is undoubtedly familiar to most of our audience?
Right, yeah, the Heartless Poker paper. I mean, I think that paper certainly wins the title, wins the award for best title of any paper. Because if you're mathematically inclined and you see a paper called Heartless Poker, I think you want to at least read the introduction of the paper. That was Dominic Lanfear, and actually Laura Talman was the co-author of that. I mentioned her a moment ago as my co-author on that book of Sudoku puzzles. So what they're studying there is this idea that in poker, just traditional five-card draw poker, so not really Texas Hold'em, which I think is what poker means to people these days, but just traditional five-card draw poker, there's always this challenge in ranking the hands, right? The idea is that a really strong hand is one that's less likely to come up. So four of a kind is certainly a much stronger hand than a three of a kind because it's much harder to get four of a kind. And then a straight flush is even better than four of a kind because it's even harder to get a straight flush than it is to get four of a kind. Okay, now anyone who has first learned poker has encountered this difficulty that you have these three hands, the straight, the flush, and the full house. And it's always, I think for beginning poker players, it's always a little hard to remember which one's the strongest hand and which one's the weakest hand. And it turns out that the straight is the weakest. In traditional poker, the straight is the weakest. In other words, it's easier to get a straight than it is to get a flush, and it's easier to get a flush than it is to get a full house. Okay, now, if you think about it, what if you used a non-standard deck of cards, right? A standard deck has four suits, and it has 13 cards in each suit. Okay, well, just imagine that you only had three suits, right? Instead of all four suits, maybe you got rid of the hearts so that you're playing heartless poker. Get it, right? So you only have the other three suits. Well, if you think about it, now it's going to be much easier to get a flush than it would have been before. With only three suits, it's much easier to get five cards of the same suit. So if you start playing games like that, if you start playing poker with a non-standard deck like that, maybe suddenly the flush is the weakest hand, and then maybe the straight is in the middle, and the full house is the strongest. So you can play games with this. You can have, say, what if you have fewer suits or more suits, or what if you have, more or less than 13 cards in each suit? Let's say, if you only had, 10 cards in each suit, it might be easier to get a straight. So that's the idea of that paper. When they talk about heartless poker, they're talking specifically, what if you play poker with a standard deck, except that you leave out the hearts? And then they go on to study other, exotic decks. In fact, you can actually buy, this is something, that's actually marketed. It's called the Fat Pack, of cards. It's basically, two standard decks, except the idea is that you have eight suits. So you have clubs, hearts, spades, diamonds. And then you have other suits they made up, like hatchets and pitchforks and things like that. And basically that's what they're doing in that paper. Now, once again, this paper is just a classic example of what gets people interested in recreational mathematics, because the basic problem here you could explain to anyone. You don't need a degree in mathematics to understand what it would mean to play poker with a non-standard deck. And you can see in general terms why, in the example I mentioned, that if you leave out the hearts, it might be easier to get a flush than it would be before. So they started studying this, and again, they tried to generalize it as much as possible. Suppose you have N suits with K cards in each suit. And what they discovered, very interestingly, was that determining the correct ordering of the hands ultimately comes down to a problem in Diophantine analysis. Now, this is actually, that's a branch of number theory. Diophantine equations refers to, certain polynomial equations where you're trying to find integer solutions. But suffice it to say, it's a big deal in number theory. So suddenly, just by studying these different decks of cards and just saying, hey, what do we need to do to solve this problem? They were led to really fundamental topics in number theory. And actually, I should mention, they had kind of interesting conclusion. What they point out is that by jiggering with the number of suits and the number of cards per suit, you can get any ordering you want. You can get you can make full house the weakest hand by picking the right deck. Or you can make the flush the strongest hand by picking the right deck. So it's another classic example of the kind of papers that we feature here. I mean, what could be more recreational than playing poker with non-standard decks, right? And then pretty soon you're doing modern number theory.
Well, actually, your non-standard decks in poker actually go back some distance, because one of the first variations of poker, and I learned this because I played poker half a century ago or started. The variation was Deuces Wild, in which all the deuces can be any card you want. And with even though that's a very, very small change, it makes the deuces any card you want in any particular hand. It changes the ranking order of the hands.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and probably most old-time poker players who were raised in an era before Texas Hold'em became the dominant form are familiar with that. We've got time for a couple of more topics from the book.
Right.
So what is an affine plane, and how does it differ from a Euclidean plane, and how does tic-tac-toe differ on the two planes?
Right, okay, yeah, so that's paper. I'm actually blanking on the authors at the moment, but I have the book right in front of me. So that was Maureen Carroll and Stephen Dougherty wrote that one. Yeah. So of course everyone's familiar with traditional tic-tac-toe, where you just play it on a on a little 3x3 grid. Very roughly, it might be a little tricky to give a precise technical definition of an affine plane, but very roughly, it's like a regular plane where you have a wraparound aspect to it. So that three in a row. Or maybe four in a row or five in a row, depending on how big the plane is that you're playing on, you have a certain wraparound. So it's like the, your three X's can go up one diagonal and then come back, through the bottom. So you have this sort of wraparound effect. Maybe some of our listeners are old enough to remember the old video game Asteroids, where the asteroid would disappear, say, on the right hand of the screen and then suddenly reappear.
And then coming on the other, I'm old enough.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. So basically, tic-tac-toe becomes a lot more interesting when you play it on an affine plane. I think everyone knows that when you just traditional 3x3 tic-tac-toe, very quickly ends in a tie. But if you imagine playing on a much larger surface and on a surface with much more interesting topological properties, then you got a very rich mathematical theory. And that's basically what Carroll and Dougherty are doing in that paper. Is analyzing what if you play games like tic-tac-toe, but on these fancier surfaces. It actually reminded me. I like to play chess. I'm an avid chess player. And one time, a fellow showed me some computer software for playing chess on a torus. So instead of playing it on a rectangle, which is hard enough, or playing on a square, I should say, which is hard enough. Now the bishop moves off the left hand side of the board and immediately appears on the right hand side of the board. So suddenly, you're in more danger than you realize. That very roughly is the gist of that paper. And you get, suddenly tic-tac-toe, which is a very boring game in its traditional form, suddenly becomes a lot of fun to play, frankly, and also a lot of fun to study mathematically.
Well, some things are easier on a torus than a plane, because I think it would... we mentioned earlier the four-color problem. I think that it was known that a map on a torus needs seven colors to color it, and I think that was known considerably before the four color problem was solved.
Oh, is that so? Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, this is one of the random, odd facts that I remember from a career in mathematics. Jason, it's been a fascinating hour talking with you, 50 minutes or so, and there are still topics in the book that we have not plumbed, but I feel that readers and the listeners would really, especially those with some degree of mathematical familiarity beyond just ordinary high school mathematics, would absolutely love this book. And I think that our listeners might like to, first of all, if they want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
I'm actually pretty easy to find online. If you just type my name into Google, my personal webpage is probably the first or second thing that comes up. I'll leave an email address. You can reach me at, I'm a professor at James Madison University. You can reach me at ROSENHJD, ROSENHJD, at JMU.edu. But frankly, if you just search for the James Madison University Department of Mathematics, you'll very quickly be led to my contact information. And I really enjoyed this conversation as well. And thank you very much for having me. And as you mentioned, there are quite a few other papers in the book that we didn't get around to. I should mention, actually, I did mention it briefly early on, but I'll mention it now. Jennifer Beinecke, my co-editor, and I are currently putting together the second volume in the series based on the Second Moves Conference that took place last August. And we're having a lot of fun with that. That should be available next year. And we're really excited about it. We have papers by Eric Demain, who's a very famous mathematician at MIT. And we have another paper by Peter Winkler. And Richard Guy has a paper in the book, and we're really excited about it. So if you like this book, volume two will be available soon enough.
And I'll want to talk to you about it.
And I'll be happy to do so.
Delighted. And also, you've told me something about what is usually my concluding question: what's next on your list of things to tackle?
Well, I'll mention two projects. Obviously, that one is the one I'm working on now. And separately from that, I'm working out actually my own book where I'll be the author, not the editor. A book actually about the history of logic puzzles and exploring exactly this theme, showing how many modern ideas in logic. I mean, logic is this big professional area. Mathematicians study logic, and philosophers study it, and computer scientists study it. And yet, a lot of what is now modern major ideas in logic can either be illustrated by or arises from, puzzles and logic. I mean, you look at Lewis Carroll, for example, Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass. Those are, they're all sorts of logical themes in those books. So that's a book that I'm working on. It'll be a little while yet before that book is available, but that's my other.
Jason, sign me up for that one, too.
Okay, great. I'll have you.
Okay. It's been a pleasure, Jason. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.